save a star.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the number one podcast that you're listening to right now, Save the Stub. With me today, I have my venerable vice captains.
Alliteration.
Yeah.
Co-captains.
Co-captains, says the bag. Rory McNair, Will Foster, how you doing, lads?
Fantastic.
Good. Uni is done. My
yes, yep. Uni has been done for about a year and a half. Yes.
We're in job application mode. And
some of us
it.
Went and did it the first time, didn't need a gap year to get it done.
Anyway,
I digress. This week we are doing Nomadland. Oscar winners, slightly interesting discussion, I would say. It's a film that will divide opinion, not just on our panel, but on you at home. Who may watch. So that'll be interesting. So yeah, stick around for that. But first, we're going to get into the news.
So, interesting news. We've got a few pretty juicy items this week. And the first one I want to talk about is the announcement of Joker 2. Which was really recent to us recording. I think this only was announced a few days ago. So thoughts, how well do we think this is going to lead on? From what I can see, they've not actually confirmed if it's a sequel or a prequel. They've just said it's an installment. So I suppose we don't really know timeline-wise where this is going to be. But
Have you two seen Joker?
Yeah, I have, yeah. Actually.
And did you like it?
I didn't think it was like as good as it was made out to be.
Yeah.
I think it was good in the kind of the way it broke the trend of superhero films. And I think Joaquin Phoenix did a good performance, but I wouldn't say it's like best film ever made, top tier ever made.
Yeah.
I feel like it's one of those films that has like a lot of fandom like around it just because it's a little bit different. But I actually did quite like it. I thought the cinematography and like how it looked was amazing. Again, I feel like this might be a bit of a theme. Like a lot of modern films these days are actually shot really well and they have lots of really beautiful scenes in them, I think anyway.
What are some of them that come to mind for you in Joker? Because I can't really think of any off the top of my head.
I think the scene at the end where there's lots of flashing lights and...
In the traffic.
He's standing on the car.
Yeah,
and you get lots of light reflection. That stands out for me a lot. I think the scene on the train was like very realistic. You have quite a good sense of some of the emotions that were going on in that scene. Just a few. I don't think it did a bad job, to be fair. I think it hit on mental health themes like it wanted to. Thought the acting was really good. There wasn't much of a plot, like it was a bit loose for me,
because this is my concern with the sequel is that I enjoyed it but I'd never watch it again. And a film that doesn't, because it was almost like a, I don't know how you'd phrase it, it's almost like a necessary watching sort of thing, but not, but sort of is on the mental health aspect. But it with that having been said, that to me screams no need for a sequel. Assuming it is a sequel. I mean, the IMDb phrases it as a sequel, but I don't, you know, how much can you trust that? And it's but it's the same director. It's Todd Phillips again, who I think he might have won an Oscar for it. I don't know if that's true or not. So that's a lot of, you know, and I assume Joaquin Phoenix is still attached. So
yeah, he can't really.
Strange. He takes primarily quite good roles as well. So I sort of trust his judgment to a degree.
My trouble with the first one was that I feel like it can't, to me, it's not really like this kind of symbolic leading the way for mental health stuff, because I didn't think it dealt with it in a very like positive or like productive way. It was quite like, this is like a mental health thing and this is why people act this way,
right?
It wasn't like, this is how you approach it and this is how you could kind of
that's a good point. Yeah, nice.
And then the way, how much do you guys think it sets itself up for a sequel? I think the end scene,
not even remotely. Yeah, I think
be either way.
Yeah, I think the whole point is it establishes him as a character rather than being like here's going to be the Joker going, because fundamentally, if you were going to take this character now and start integrating him with things like Batman, it wouldn't make sense, because he's not, they've not painted him as evil mastermind, as a psychopath who wants to, you know, rule the world but also just fuck with people. They've just painted him as someone who's got some power accidentally through misfortune and fortune. So they can't, I don't think they can do the superhero route per se. So where does that leave them to go if it is a sequel? I don't get a lot from it.
Well, that's why I'm glad that kind of the back door for a prequel might be on the cards, because it might be interesting to take a step back, kind of seeing how the mental health issues developed, because I don't think we got much of that in the original film.
But then my argument with
that is that it can't go anywhere because of where Joker started.
Yeah, because the whole point is that the only reason, the only reason people wanted to watch the Joker is because it had the Joker in. If you just paint it as slightly mentally unstable man, you know, kills a talk show host and goes a bit crazy as the leader of a mob, it wouldn't sell, really, would it? It's more, oh, you know who the Joker is, you know, you know of Jack Nicholson, Heath Ledger, all the rest who've done it. So for them to then put it in like, oh, it could just be like a kid growing up, or like a troubled teenager.
Yeah, and it's basically not a superhero. Like,
isn't it? Yeah, do I even want to watch that? Yeah. That just sounds... Number one, it sounds depressing. But number two, it just sounds a bit disinteresting.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like we're not actually too keen on that one.
Yeah. But again, it's one I'd probably go and see if there was enough being said about it to warrant. But it doesn't grab me.
All right. Next bit of news. It's quite significant, actually, in... kind of like the business side of things, I suppose. MGM has been acquired by Amazon. So this is Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. They're a massive film franchise. And for anyone that's listening that doesn't know them by name, it's the one with the lion logo at the start of lots of things that you would have seen. Like Tom and Jerry was the one that came to my mind. What do we think about this? Interesting. I guess the number one thing is that a lot of these franchises now are they're on Amazon Prime, and That's going to be it.
So it's the biggest acquisition Amazon have made since Whole Foods. So this is them grabbing the streaming market, because I think I'd seen somewhere that their grips actually got getting weaker and weaker by like the minute with the number of streaming services that have cropped up. But ultimately, it's not going to be any one that can take the lead unless they can amalgamate loads of different studios and stuff like that.
Yeah.
The main thing I saw them going for was James Bond.
Yeah,
obviously that must make $1 billion every time they post a film out. I don't really know, but it must make silly amounts of money.
Yeah,
and it's one of those franchises that's it's almost timeless. You can almost just keep making stuff because he doesn't age, doesn't die, he doesn't just sort of exists, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Someone else said the Rocky franchise, but the fuck's watching Rocky films now? Do you know what I mean?
I mean, we got Pink Panther, G.I. Joe, The Hobbit.
And there actually is a new G.I. Joe coming out, so maybe that
Legally Blonde.
Yeah, The Addams Family. That's
Did you say The Hobbit?
Series. Yeah, The Hobbit, apparently.
That's weird, isn't it? Because Amazon already have Lord of the Rings.
Well, you know, this is what it's about, isn't
that's
it?
That's strange, isn't it?
Trying to get as much as possible. I was just going to say, I think, so this is the first big move from a streaming service to, like, acquire, you know, like a production house. I think the only way that someone like Netflix can now go is do the same, to be fair. But I don't know who suits that, because 21st Century Fox, that's now Disney, isn't it?
Yes.
Big other ones. What, Lionsgate? Are they big?
Lionsgate, I think they're a UK team, so they're probably not actually that big, Lionsgate. But even thinking about, you know, apparently James Bond is the fifth most valuable movie franchise of all time. Behind
now streaming, so you know that's Amazon.
Yeah, now. Behind, you know, Marvel, Star Wars, Harry Potter, and Spider-Man. Apparently, that's got its own universe. And obviously, some people will say, "Oh, but it's because they're." I think it's something like 8,000 films they got the right to by acquiring MGM. But a lot of them are things, you know, like golden era films. You know, your Ben Hur's, your a little less golden era, but Raging Bull, stuff like that. But I actually think it's more, you've got the property for those names. So any remake, any sequel, any prequel, instantly you own everything for it. So I wouldn't be shocked if Amazon start just pumping out big budget films from a bygone era in their own way, which would be weird.
Yeah, definitely. I don't think this is the last of it either. I think more, you know, people got to compete.
So 100%.
We'll see where that goes. All right. Last bit of news, a bit lighter, a bit less businessy. Timothée Chalamet has been cast as the new Willy Wonka in a prequel to the 2005 film with Johnny Depp in it. This is going to be set before, obviously, the chocolate factory had been set up and stuff. Interesting.
Who asked for a Willy Wonka?
Who asked for this fucking film? What exec sat down and went, do you know who people want to hear the story of? Is the fucking purple dude from that film. Yeah, I'd honestly rather see an origin story for like the Oompa Loompas.
Well, at least they are, there's content from Roald Dahl about them, I suppose. But
didn't we already see like an origin story in that film?
Isn't it him like hating dentists and shit? Isn't that his origin?
His dad's Christopher
Lee.
Yeah.
It's so long ago since I watched that film, to be fair.
He just got fat braces, doesn't like going to the dentist, so he eats sweets all the time. I think isn't that the plot?
Yeah.
And then he goes to a jungle and hunts Oompa Loompas.
So it's explained.
But at that point, he's already like 20. There is like a 20-year gap, I think. Because he's like 5 when he hates his dad, and then he's 20-something when he's looking for Oompa Loompas.
Are they going to do Willy Wonka, Wolf of Wall Street, acquires the empire, build? Like, who cares?
But Willy Wonka's always been a bit creepy, so I feel like, do you really want to do an origin story of someone who's a bit like seedy? And
Johnny
bit,
Depp's
like...
one fully gives me like Savile vibes.
Exactly.
That haircut, that trim is.
Gene Wilder's one was at least sort of like endearing, wasn't it? Or kind of like a genius. Willy Wonka, Johnny Depp's one's horrid.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, Timothy's going to be singing and dancing for the first time as well in this movie. What a heartthrob, eh?
Need. I wonder how much they're paying him. Imagine it's more than 10.
Don't even talk. And the last bit on top of that is directed by Paul King, who made the Paddington films. I don't know if either of
those. Oh, apparently they're amazing. Though.
I've heard good things about them.
Seen the second one and it was quite enjoyable, but I watched it with my family.
Started on the sequel.
Yeah, that's strange.
Yeah, I didn't watch the first one. No. Don't ask.
That is weird. Where's he from? Isn't he from Argentina? Peru. Why is he from Peru? What does that mean?
No, Paddington.
Oh, Paddington's from Peru. But why is he from Peru? Isn't he like quintessentially like British?
Yeah, he doesn't have.
Didn't he get like Peruvian he got like delivered accent. In? He got delivered in. He was like stuck in a bar. I can't remember. Hang on. Let's see. This is the real origin story we want. We want the Paddington Bear origin.
Yeah, can you imagine him like with like? I thought I say Aztecs. That's embarrassing. Like Incas knocking about in Peru. Just
in the deepest jungles of darkest Peru, a British geographer discovers a previously unknown species of bear. He's about to shoot it to take the specimen back to the United Kingdom when a second bear playfully takes his gun away and saves his life by removing a deadly scorpion from his jacket. He learns that the bears are intelligent and can learn English, that they have a deep appetite for marmalade, and names them Lucy after his mother and Pastuso after an exotic boxer he once met. As he departs, he throws his hat to Pastuso and tells the bears that they are always welcome if they wish to go to London.
That is the
40 years later, the two
story.
Bears are living in harmony with their orphan nephew until an earthquake destroys their home, forcing them to seek shelter underground.
Interesting.
Underground bear from Peru.
Oh, so the nephew. Marmalade. So the two aunt and uncle are being killed in this earthquake, and the aunt sends the nephew, who is Paddington, to London to like save him, and he arrives at Paddington Station.
That sounds like a Joker origin story. I'd watch that over Willy Wonka one, 100%. To be fair though, as long as Grandpa Joe's not in it, I might watch it.
Well, I was just about to say that the script has been written with Simon Farnaby as well, and he wrote the Horrible History series, which I'm sure we can all agree
banger
bangs.
These have all got similar vibes, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean.
I just don't know who asked for it though. Do you know what I mean? Like, where are they? They must do like, you know, like not polls, but like focus groups.
Yeah, sure.
And at some point, one idiot's gone, I bet we can make them make a Willy Wonka origin story. And they've fucking gone and done it.
It might sell quite well though if it's got Timothy Chalamet in it.
And fundamentally, it is for kids. I don't know why I'm getting so annoyed about it. It's not for me, is it?
Mm-hmm. But that's the thing, though. So, like, does Timothy Chalamet really appeal to, like, kids yeah, when this film's true. Actually going
to
be released?
I don't know if they need him to appeal to kids, though. The kids don't know who's acting. They didn't know it was Johnny Depp. They didn't know it was Gene Wilder. I just feel like they just quite like colours. And they get famous people in for kids' films all the time, don't they? Always get famous voices for kids' films. It doesn't matter, though, does it? No one cares.
He's a bit of a heartthrob, though, isn't he, for the old teenage girls?
That's what I'm saying.
Maybe he'll be a fit Willy Wonka.
But who's that? You know, how old is he? Like, what, 23?
Maybe it'll be like a really, like an 18. Like Willy Wonka.
Really coming of age film.
Fucks yeah. and sucks his way gone. Around. Wherever the hell they live.
He's gone through some shit.
Wow. I'd watch that.
Well,
maybe.
On that, I think that's the end of the news.
On to the mailbag and starting us off with a question. I don't know if this is from you, Harry, or someone you know, but what movie or TV scenes do you come back and watch over and over again? Someone give me something.
Oh.
Have you got any, Will? Because I can go.
You roll off. You go.
I don't know if either of you have seen Sicario. I feel like one of you has and doesn't like it.
I haven't.
I haven't, but I'm like waiting to see it because I like all Denis Villeneuve's films. So.
There's a scene in the first half an hour odd on a like motorway just outside of Mexico that is incredible. Like I think it's like a good film, but that scene's different class. What other? I mean, you can pick pretty much. Oh, the wave scene for Interstellar as well. It's just Benny.
Is there like a TikTok in that scene? As in like, is there like a ticking clock as well?
Apparently that was Hans Zimmer, the guy who does the music for pretty much every Christopher Nolan film and every big film, was only given one A4 page of description on the film and that metronome to build the soundtrack off. So I think it's constantly going in the film, or at any point where his music's in, there is a metronome in it, which is kind of cool.
Nice.
What about you, Will?
It's so sad. I feel like I used to get more excited as a child about films like that I'd want to rewatch than I do now.
You've done a film podcast, mate.
I know. I think the only times that I get that feeling where something like really hits me hard and is like something to rewatch is always like a sad moment.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
The only thing that's sticking in my mind at the moment is Boy in Striped Pyjamas.
Oh, I've not even seen that. I'm bad.
That's morbid. It's a good film, but it's very like, hard to watch.
Yeah, it's painful. Very difficult to watch. The shower scene is, they're the types of scenes that just stick in my mind. It's not like.
See, the question was more, what do you come back and watch again rather than like.
What has traumatized you as a child?
That's what I mean. I don't know. I've not gone back to films. Like I said, it was only as a kid. Like if you like saw a film that you loved, you'd want to watch it like again and again. I don't really get.
And
that.
You loved the shower.
Yeah, but like what? And say one of the ones you saw when you were a kid. Not.
I always found the scene where Woody and Buzz were on the back of the RC car and they were trying to get on the back of the.
Oh, line. That's a good.
There you go.
Film.
That's the answer you wanted. Look at life. We're doing frothy podcasts, not. God, doesn't it hit you hard when you watch that scene in Boy in the Striped Pyjamas?
I don't know.
We've already talked about The Matrix, but my like 12-year-old figuring out what was cool thing was the scene where he like. So first he goes into the like blank bit of The Matrix and is like, "We're gonna need guns, lots of guns," and they just like get delivered loads of guns. And then there's a scene where they go into like the multi-story building to save Morpheus. And he like walks through the metal detector and the guy's like, can you like take away any keys or change or whatever? And he just like opens his coat and it's just nothing but weaponry. Oh. And he just like kills everyone. Yeah, that's a good scene.
Have I got any more? Come on, Will.
The ending of Inception. That's really good. That's iconic, that scene.
That's a very good ending. That's probably one of the best endings I've seen.
Yeah, I would agree. People are really ambiguous about it. I think it's quite clear what happens, but.
Oh, I don't know what happens.
Oh, I fully believe it's like quite obvious. But
is it like you can hear something, but it like goes to black, but you can still hear something?
No, he spins the top, and you don't see it fall.
Yeah.
Which so you can't tell.
I suppose, yeah, it is going to fall.
You can't tell if he's if it's real or not. But I mean, mm-hmm. I think it's quite unambiguous. But some people claim either way.
Oh, go on then, Harry.
Can you make your claims?
Put your flag in
the 100% it's real. He goes and sees his kids. Like, the whole point of being locked in the dream is that he can't remember their faces. So for him to hug them, he has to remember their faces, which I think means he can't be in a dream.
Unless he's making them up.
I would also argue if it's good enough that he can make it up, he is in reality. So it doesn't bother me.
Yeah, that's true. He's kind of got what he wants.
That's what I mean. Yeah, it's almost like even if it isn't reality, it sort of is. So it kind of doesn't matter to me.
Yeah,
so, but I do think it is. I think it's reality. I think I've sort of just accepted that.
Nice.
There we go.
Oh, right. One more. Sorry. I don't know if either of you have seen American Psycho. Looking at their business cards.
Oh, that is a good. That's a great scene, actually.
That is so weird. It's like a comedy, but not. But it's really good.
I can't remember. You like, he's looking at the card, but you see like the sweat on his brow.
Yeah. So apparently, Christian Bale would sweat for the take. He is able to make himself sweat on cue.
Oh, Prince Andrew would love it.
I read that a couple of days ago. Shut up, fucking. Apparently he can do that, so he wouldn't sweat, and they get to the like minute mark in the scene, and he'd be sweating from his forehead. Like, how could that is mad, isn't it? I don't know if that's true, but that's kind of crazy.
I thought of another one as well. Have you seen A Bug's Life?
Yes.
This scene where they're getting attacked by the grasshoppers, and they're
Attack of the Clones.
All the food gets fucked off. Oh, that's mad.
That's pretty mad. Yeah.
I think it's at the start, yeah.
Yeah, isn't it at the start? Because there's a lot of like dead animals, aren't there? It's quite morbid, but like a good scene.
Again, what am I watching?
Isn't it like happening like their legs blown off and stuff?
Who are your favourite characters in A Bug's Life?
Oh, it's got to be the caterpillar.
Heimlich is literally my favourite character.
Oh, I think it's like Bill Ant. Isn't he a bit of a baller?
Bill Ant?
Like the Jack Ant. Like one of the ants is like ripped.
He said built, not Bill the Ant.
Bill, yeah.
Bill Ant Bug.
There's like one ant. Don't Google that. You're going to get some like Rule 34 stuff. You don't need that.
It's the scene at the end where Heimlich gets wings and becomes a butterfly.
Yeah.
And he's just still really fat, but he's got these tiny wings.
Does he have one where they're in like a bar and he flirts with like a stick insect? There's actually just a
stick. So it's the like it's an insect that flirts with the ladybird, but the ladybird is a man. Or he's kind of like gender neutral. He's got like a really deep voice.
Bugs Life's
ahead of its time, I'll tell you what.
And when they're in the back of that caravan and they're like, they don't know what they're going to do.
Right, so I saw a TikTok yesterday that said that every character in A Bug's Life represents a different kind of like disorder in a person. So
clever.
Yeah.
This is what I mean, great. Kids' films. This is what
you need to get off the internet, mate. Stop going on TikTok.
Right, should we go on to a new question?
Yeah. Okay.
What is the best sequel ever made that you've seen? Okay.
The Dark Knight.
A classic answer.
Or Aliens.
Yeah. Ooh, that was going to be one of my answers.
Because Alien is good, but Aliens is top tier.
Rory?
Oh, okay.
Please.
Well, this has always been my answer, but having rewatched the first one a few times recently, I'm not sure, but I'd go with Shrek 2.
I've seen some interesting debate on this online.
Because Shrek 2 is really good, but I've seen Shrek like twice in the past year and really enjoyed it both times. And I'm kind of like, this doesn't need a sequel.
So Shrek 1 is Lord Farquaad.
Yeah.
Shrek 2 is when the dragon and the king and queen come into it. And
fairy godmother.
That is a better one than the first one, I agree.
Yeah.
There's more to it, yeah.
And the animation quite clearly steps up. Number one looks bad now.
I rewatched number one just a couple of days ago. Actually, I didn't catch all of it. Just my flatmate had it on, and yeah, you could tell that
as you do.
Getting
you and your house just kids.
Yeah, basically
Ratatouille and Shrek.
Yeah, Ratatouille, Shrek, Bug's Life, and then A Boy in the Striped Pyjamas when they want to lower the tone.
Honestly, that anyone listening, actually, just on a side note, that is a once a year kind of watch film. You don't want to be watching that.
Once a year, yeah.
On that note, the Toy Stories films do a really good job of sequeling, I feel. 1 to 2 and 2 to 3. 3 still a really good film.
I forget what happens in two, because one, does one have Sid?
Yeah. Two is Woody and the Collector, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They have to go Jesse. To the...
That's a good scene. The guy cleaning Woody.
Yeah, that's a great scene.
Yeah.
Animation that is a good scene. Forgot that. That sounds a bit wrong what I said, though, doesn't it?
On a
bit in Toy Story 2 when he cleans his Woody.
Oh, God.
The prospect is so evil in that film.
He is, isn't he?
I watched it recently and it like stressed me out how evil he was.
He is a knobhead.
Stinky Pete.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, and even that Pete. Name sort of like annoys me. Just, like, who's like buying that, you freak?
No, that's a very good sequel. And yeah, I think 3 is quite good as well, to be fair. I've heard bad things about 4, but
I've never seen 4.
Not part of the conversation. Seen 4. Neither have I. Maybe we should.
No, wait, wasn't it really positive 4?
No, 3 was positive. And then like 3 was like, I didn't need a sequel because they got to the end and they were all alive.
Yeah. Then they just say goodbye and then...
Spork character into number 4.
Oh, yeah, and...
A spork?
Yeah.
Well, it's not a toy?
Yeah, it's like a spork with like pipe cleaners for arms or something. And then what's it called? Keanu Reeves is in it and some other people.
Is he? Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah, he plays like a stuntman. Like a toy.
Yeah.
I think it's Evil Knievel is who he's playing. Something like that.
I think the Star Wars originals as well, they're good sequels. I think I've had a lot of people say that number 5 was their favourite. Obviously, it comes after number 4. And I quite like number 6, actually. So,
yeah.
Why? Why the fuck did I say?
Yeah, no, I don't know why you told us that 4 is before 5.
It's in case we're,
you know, some hard of thinking people.
All right, another question. Should, or how much, to what extent, should a film's soundtrack be noticeable? It's a bit of a weird question. I think it's more kind of, how much should you notice a film's soundtrack while you're watching it, essentially, is the question.
I think there's an argument to say that a soundtrack that you don't notice is a really good one.
I think it's both ways.
I feel like that has to be qualified by you get to the end of the film and you thought it was a really good film.
Yeah.
Because say there was just like a no soundtrack that you, and that's why you didn't notice it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in the sense that there is music and things going on. It's probably the sense that as well, it just doesn't stand out as being glaringly obviously bad.
There's a difference between a good soundtrack and good scoring, though, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. As in, have you seen Booksmart? It's a film that came out a couple of years ago. It's actually quite good, sort of a coming of age teenager film, but that's all popular chart music, but it's used really, really well, as opposed to like Hans Zimmer that we were speaking about earlier, where it's like orchestral music made solely for the film. Both can be used in different ways really, really well. So like whilst
it's
I love
the mix of the two,
yeah, but so like I love like the Interstellar soundtrack, obviously that's amazing, but also hearing songs that I sort of know used really, really well is, I would say, as good, if not sometimes better. That's why I like Drive for me, because some of the soundtrack is like actual music, just picked so well for the thing.
I noticed that today because I was watching Gross Point Blank, which, having watched it for like the fourth time today, like as in like fourth time ever today. It's actually like a really good film. It's about like John Cusack's this hitman who gets invited back to his high school reunion when he's like going through a bit of an existential crisis.
That's cool.
Gross Point Blank. But it's all kind of about him being weirdly conflicted as being like a hitman, but also like moving on in life, but also him returning to high school and having all this like nostalgia about the 80s. But I've realized the soundtrack is all like 80s bangers, but they're played in the moments where you're meant to feel nostalgic and he's meant to feel nostalgic.
Yeah.
And it's just like makes the film a lot more like fun, and it kind of structures it really well because the end plays like an 80s banger and it's like, oh, that's definitely the end of the film. Nice.
I definitely do notice soundtracks that don't fit as well, though. It's very, a lot of Americanized films will use just normal orchestral music for anything where they're suggesting it's dramatic or sad. Jarring, like this is gonna be so abstract. Gordon Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmares. Have you ever seen an episode?
Yes.
They just use the most bait music for everything. If they're trying to imply someone is stupid, they use this sort of like ploddy music. And then for like a scene that's not actually not that dramatic, it's dun 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 dun.
No, like, it's the same doing? With all reality TV. Like you'll watch Love Island and someone will say something and it's like boom boom. And it's like, yeah. If it had been played with happy music, it would have just been like,
yeah,
a joke.
Just any other comment.
When someone says something like shady or like against someone else, the rattlesnake sound comes out.
Yeah, in it. It's like, shut up. It's like it's subconscious, you know, advertising of what's going on, isn't it? And some films are guilty of that. Not good films, typically. But there are definitely some blockbusters that just ram in some fancy music because they have to.
Mm. Well, that brings us to the end of our questions. A lovely mailbag.
Film of the week.
So this month, we reviewed the Oscar-scooping new film, Nomadland. By Chloe Zhao, who I think won an Oscar herself for it. It's a weird one. It's essentially about a woman losing everything in the Great Recession, moving into a camper van and living her life day to day as a modern day nomad, hence the name Nomadland. It's quite an eclectic story. It's sort of a meandering one. I'd say how I describe it. What were your initial thoughts? Will, I'll come to you first.
I went into it with a quite open mind, but quite quickly, I kind of think I figured out what it was all about. And to be honest, I didn't really like it. I didn't think it was that good. It got quite a lot of nominations. And did it win some things as well?
It won 230 awards.
Oh, my God.
IMDb including tells me, including three Oscars.
Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Actress.
So, theoretically, the big three.
Oh, that pains me. That actually makes me feel a bit ill.
Does it? So would you, I mean, actually, maybe I'll ask this question later, but it's one to think about. Sound of Metal comparatively didn't win all the awards that it was hyped to get, but Nomadland did. Would you say that you would have reversed those?
Oh, yeah, a million percent. I think what's difficult, you touched on this in the intro, it is a bit of a film without a set story, and it's one that kind of just follows someone about a bit. Maybe I'm discovering that I'm just not really a fan of those kind of films.
Well, that's the thing, because I feel like personally, I agree with stuff you've said, and I didn't think it was amazingly gripping or engaging. But I imagine this film appeals to people of a certain age. And I think when you reach a certain age in your life, a lot of the kind of ideas that she talks about become a lot more relatable and understandable. And me personally, I was watching the film kind of being like, I find her quite irritating as a character. I find the kind of story not that interesting. And like, she doesn't seem to develop very much. And there were scenes towards the end where it was like, oh, maybe she is starting to develop. And it was like, there's not quite enough there to convince me that that's true.
Yeah.
Which meant that by the end, I was kind of like, what have I actually learned or been told in this film?
I feel like there's just an overwhelming sense of, yeah, like what's actually happened by the end of this film. Like, so the character, what have I learnt about the location that it's set, the people that were part of the story. Just like a lot of nothingness, really, to be honest.
Here we go, though. Harry, it was a month ago. What did you make of the film?
I think I do agree with what you say, as in I think it is a film for a demographic. It's borderline a tribute. I mean, a lot of actors in this who aren't actors, who are real-life nomads, it was in memory of someone, I believe, at the end of the film, who was a real-life nomad, who either Chloe Zhao knew or that the book was dedicated to. And it is, a lot of it is about sort of the fragility of life, but still the ability to break free and sort of abandon the, I don't know, it sounds a bit cringe what I was about to say there, but shackles of capitalist society and things like that, to live in a caravan and shit in a caravan and all the other things. But for me, the most interesting stuff was probably the really stark contrast of like Amazon warehouses, for example, to being in the middle of absolutely nowhere.
Yeah.
But within the space of maybe a day or a week for these people, given that they've been cast out of their regular or normal lives before that point because of the recession.
Yeah, this gave me kind of Into the Wild vibes a bit.
Yeah, so this was what I was almost going to compare it, but I was wondering if you didn't want to do Into the Wild. We might as well say it. I think this does a less effective job than Into the Wild for the connection with nature,
yeah,
which is what I enjoyed from Into the Wild. but it also does a more effective job of demonstrating why society is something you might want to break free from than Into the Wild does.
Yeah, and I think in a way that was kind of the purpose of Into the Wild, to be fair.
Yeah, but I still think Into the Wild struggled to actually illustrate why he was so concerned with not being a regular human.
Yeah,
because exactly. They sort of detailed that his parents were, you know, awful people and they only cared about money and that, but it didn't sort of explain why he had an inherent disbelief and a distrust, because he had a sister who didn't feel that way, or, you know, there are other people in similar situations who don't suddenly go off grid. Whereas at least with Nomadland, you know, I understand her husband's died, her entire way of life is essentially shut down when her mining town disappears, and she does essentially what she has left to do by moving in and taking the little bit of money she has. But in that way, it is a story that fundamentally can only meander. I don't really know what they can do with it other than explain the life of a nomad.
Sorry, Rory, go on.
That contrast and that conflict between, we talked about it already, but like the materialism and then breaking free and like people who choose that life versus people who are part of society, I found it kind of weird in the film. I didn't think they achieved it very well in that she did all this stuff, and the scene at the beginning where she's talking to her sister seems kind of accepting and there's no like major conflict there. And then she comes back and all of a sudden she's like getting really angry and like telling the people that are there, like, oh, you're just part of this like horrible society where like material is all that matters. And I'm like, what's driven that anger? Because it didn't seem that genuine. Like if you are breaking free, you're probably happy doing your own thing. And you know, the guy who's a real nomad, who's like leader of that kind of mini group, he talks about how like, yeah, we know people live like this. That's perfectly fine. We just choose to go and do our own thing. She seemed very angry and like emotional about something.
Yeah, because that's interesting you say that. He was more grounded, wasn't he? I could understand. And whilst I didn't love, like, I understand why they've used real people, but it's not something I fundamentally love watching in the film, because they're telling the truth, but they're telling it to a camera because they know the camera's there. They're not telling it in their own sort of more nuanced way. And I get that. I still think that's a good thing for Chloe Zhao to have done as a director. But I did want to see some sort of emotion to it, because it was just Frances McDormand acts while some people actually exist. And they didn't know she was an actor either, so they're talking to her as if she's a real person, which almost makes the interactions feel a bit... Maybe that's why they felt so meager and so sort of no drive to them, because there wasn't any drive. It's a regular conversation between people.
I thought that was ambitious, though.
And that may be why she's got these awards, because it was ambitious and because it's different. So many times we'll see something win because it's different.
What did you two make of the acting performances overall? I mean, when it comes to them, there's basically two, and that's Frances McDormand and David Strathairn, kind of her love interest, if you can call it that.
I guess you'd call him that, yeah. Sorry, do you want to go? You go, Will.
Yeah, go for it, Will.
I would say I think Frances' performance was pretty good. I think for me, like, the acting in general was by the main characters was probably the highlight. That might indicate what my score is going to be a bit later, judging by what we've already said about it. But yeah, I thought she did quite a good job. I think she definitely had the look of someone that was kind of run down by society.
That is a horrible thing to say about a three-time Oscar winner.
I mean, I don't think she'll mind. I'm not sure she'll listen to this, but
no.
I think they cast her quite well. I did see emotions reflected in her performance that I could at least understand where they were coming from. So, I mean, surely that's a sign of some success.
I wonder if it also did give me an odd sense of, whilst obviously she's portraying the life of a nomad, someone sort of free from usual routine, her life very much was cyclical. You know, she starts the year in the Amazon warehouse and rounds out the year in the Amazon warehouse and did the same thing at least twice, three times in that film. So I wonder if there's a message behind that. But this feels like something that I'm almost having to read into too much, because I didn't feel like there was enough there just to be offered to me at face value. Having said that, one thing I did love, it was the environment. I thought there are very few films that use sort of America to its fullest. And whilst we maybe didn't get sort of the national park sort of, Yosemite vibes, we did get the cold winter of sort of Northwest America all the way down to sort of the more arid, the more desolate stuff you get slightly further south. And I thought those looked amazing.
Yeah.
Very few films actually seem to get it right by not over-egging it or almost building a whole film around the fact that it looks pretty. This was a film that is incidentally very good looking through shots rather than, oh, I'm building it off the fact that they're in a nice location.
There's an interesting scene. I feel like a lot of films is interesting seeing when we just talked about scenes in the mailbag, but like scenes that if you just cut them out of the film, they're kind of like a short film version of that whole film and like have the same meaning. There's a scene where they're working on the kind of camp RV site and they go to this like national park study thing for the day, go on a tour, and she basically just like sprints off into the distance. I feel like that kind of sums the film up quite well.
Where she almost gets lost but doesn't.
I don't think I didn't personally feel like it was about her getting lost. I felt like it was more her getting to the point where she didn't feel connected to all those people on the tour. Mm. There was still something about it. Maybe it was just because of like my personal relation to the character. I just found it really irritating.
See, it's interesting though, because we're saying these things, but we are fundamentally having a sort of a thought-provoked discussion. So I wonder if we can be too critical of the fact that it didn't offer too much at face value, because we have all obviously made our own. Maybe that's just a byproduct of us having to do it for a podcast and speak about it, but we obviously are making our own sort of fundamental conclusions about what the meaning behind some scenes and actions and character motives were.
But I think that's why it comes down to demographic, because say we were that target demographic, we'd have similar conversations, but we'd be like, oh, I really understand why she did these things, rather than let's figure out why or like how she does them. So I think it's still probably a good film in that regard, like you say, because it's generating that conversation.
And there is quite a central theme of the fragility of life and sort of disease and illness, and cancer gets thrown in more than a few times, doesn't it, really?
Yeah.
You know, she'd lost her husband, some of the people she meets on the site aren't particularly well, and that's why they're doing it, or they were doing this and then they've also become quite ill. And I suppose, I don't know, I get that, but I don't really get what the meaning behind it was, unless you're just trying to illustrate that people do pass, people do get ill and not make it and things like that.
I think that again comes down to the, no, not the demographic, but say you are someone who has lost a loved one and is like questioning where you go in life.
Sure.
Or like you've reached an age where you're seeing a lot of the people around you kind of either moving on to different things or passing away. You kind of question that existential question of like, what do I do now? Am I still the same person I was when I've lost everyone around me? But I felt like in that way, what did you think of David Strathairn's performance as that other character? Because it seemed really like ham-fisted in him being like a love interest. I didn't feel like it needed, maybe that's the point of the characters, that he was like desperately chasing after her and she was kind of like, I don't care.
I think had there been any more sort of actual visible romance stuff, yes, I would agree. But I think because everything was almost entirely non-verbalized and non-physical, I didn't hate it. Yeah. And the way I'm thinking about it is we were almost watching a full year of her life. I don't find it unrealistic that at some point, she did meet someone. I mean, meeting him a few times and then, you know, meeting his family stuff was probably a bit much for me. That was a bit ham-fisted when they go, oh, here's a baby, all this stuff. But her meeting him and maybe finding, because that wouldn't shock me if you were two lonely people on the path of being a nomad, if that was a very real example of what does happen sometimes, especially between, you know, widowed mid-60s, drifters essentially.
Yeah, and she was unsure as well, wasn't she, at the start about how she felt about him, and I appreciated that was probably a real, you know, something that you might see as well in that kind of situation. So I agree. Sorry. Do we want to talk about music? I only bring it up because we talked about it.
I fully don't remember any.
Well, it's kind of relevant to the mailbag in a way, because I'm exactly the same. But we can't talk about it if no one remembers it. So,
see, I think I remember during the film, there were moments of kind of filling the gap with a bit of calm, nice music. Mm. But I think it's interesting, it goes one way or the other. So like for you guys, there was nothing noticeable or impactful enough that you remembered the score.
Yeah.
For me, while I was watching it was the complete opposite, where I'd hear something and be like, oh, that's some nice music, which I didn't know if that was a good or a bad thing, because it's like, should I be noticing this, or is it meant to kind of be one piece altogether of like multimedia storytelling? And I think I got to the end and I was kind of like, they kind of layered music over all the emotional bits where there wasn't any dialogue. And I didn't think that was that effective, because it's kind of just like, here it is. Here's the bit that, you know, here's where you can think, rather than we're actually showing you stuff.
Again, it's that, and I wrote it in my review, this is fundamentally not a film for everyone, is it? It'll be interesting. I mean, my parents are watching it right now with my sister. I'd be interested to see what they think. This is the classic film where I say I don't love it as much as they do, and they say, well, you didn't understand the adult themes. And I say, shut up.
Well, but are we going to do Into the Wild full, do we think? Or is it giving away too much if I kind of say how I felt about that one?
Tell you what, we'll do it, but we won't do it for at least like 3 or 4 episodes.
Yeah, so. I fundamentally, you're not going to do a massive insight on the film, are you? You're just going to sort of contrast. Yeah.
So,
go on, Will.
Yeah, similar theme, but a similar ilk in that I didn't really relate to that character either, and he was a lot younger than the main character in this film.
That's a fair point.
But again, this might just be me. You know, filmmaking is an art form, and in this sense, I want a story and I want to be told a story, but that doesn't necessarily have to be a really intricate plot. But I still want something out of that, like some kind of development. And I just didn't feel it with this film. And that's why I think fundamentally it kind of, it fails for me.
I mean, from what we've said, maybe it is just a case of naivety on the part of 23 year olds having not, I've maybe experienced as much life or seen as many films or had the sort of perspective, hindsight, that someone who is twice our age will have watching this film, which I don't think we can
probably,
yeah, which I don't think we can be criticized for, because opinion's still valid to someone who maybe the film doesn't apply to.
Well, yeah, this is what I mean, you know, make that accessible, kind of like explain why then, like explain how I should.
Which, if anything, makes the Oscar maybe slightly stranger, especially in all three, because I totally agree with you. I think Sound of Metal, 100% in my mind, is a better film than this one.
Yeah,
I didn't mind this film, but it wasn't a Best Picture sort of grabber for me. Not for story, not for acting, not for any of those. You know, you could argue direction. I think you could argue direction, but strange one. It's not one that I would end up recommending. It's not one that I think, oh, I'd like to watch Nomadland again. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I would.
I think it's tough, because when it comes to awards, you get split into these different age demographics where it's like, this is, I'm not trying to sound pretentious or anything, but like young people say sub 16, 15, they like haven't really developed any kind of connections, right, relationships, things like that. People over like 30 are already in the world of work, potentially moving on from that. They've kind of, their relationships are a lot more grounded and or breaking down.
Yeah.
And they've got a different outlook on life. And that middle group, like I think all your critics, all the people deciding on awards are going to be for like 30 plus.
Yeah, fundamentally they will be, won't they? I wonder maybe if that counted against Sound of Metal in a lot of cases. I wonder if a lot of people actually shut off as soon as they started watching it, because they just thought this could be a film about heavy metal.
Yeah,
but I suppose that's not for us to, yeah, I don't need to start back up on what I thought of Sound of Metal. Strange though, again, looking at things surrounding it there, you know, a lot of non-real actors, just actual people, you know, apparently made on a budget of only $5 million, which is so small compared to anything you'd see in Hollywood nowadays. I suppose you could argue that this is borderline like an independent indie film, really, couldn't you, in terms of subject matter and the way it's played. Obviously, it's got a massive name with Frances McDormand. You know, she's won 2 Oscars already for Best Actress before she won this one. But it just doesn't grip, doesn't really. Fundamentally, having said it about 10 minutes ago, I don't think it does provoke thought that much. I think it's just the fact that we're trying to reason for why this has been taken so successfully and not so.
It's interesting
just...
comparing it to finish your point.
No, I was drifting, yeah.
Like the Coen brothers, obviously they've got that Frances McDormand connection. She's married to Joel Coen.
Joel.
And I think they they were kind of semi-involved in an unofficial way in Nomadland.
Will, do you know who the Coen brothers are?
I would recognise the name, but I would
Fargo.
Big Lebowski,
Ballad of Buster Scruggs was what they, I think that's might be their most recent film. A lot of really big films.
But their films are all so like narrative story,
very
driven,
much so.
Complex, like loads of stuff going on at once.
Character development, yeah.
Yeah. And this seems to take such a dive from that, which I guess kind of shows a bit of range from Frances McDormand that she's managed to really focus in on this very specific character who is the focus of the film, and she knows like attention is not going to go on anyone else by the time you get to the end of the film.
Yeah. And casting wise, McDormand is perfect. I mean, she I feel like for a while now she's fit the mold of stronger, independent, slightly maybe confrontational woman. Yeah. Particularly as she got older, you know, she's borderline playing the same role as Three Billboards but without the dark humor mixed in, I think. And it all looks like it stemmed from that Fargo role she did way, way back, where she was that police chief in a hostile environment dealing with her own things. So I think she's really well cast. And she does do a good job. You know, even her walking around that Amazon warehouse saying hi to people and sort of being semi-awkward but having to make conversation really did sort of get me, because I was like, that is really what I think it looks like on the inside. You know, so bleak. And Amazon actually offered up the warehouse. They asked them and they said yes, because I think they thought it was an excellent PR move. If that's like a cleaned up warehouse, I dread to, you know, that's them on their best behavior. I dread to see what it's like on an actual work day with people having to actually do that to sustain life. Is bleak, isn't it?
Should we get on to rating this film?
Yeah. Will, do you want to go first? Because I feel like yours is going to be a nice low benchmark.
I discussed the elements of the film I liked, so I'll get straight into it. I would give it a 6. I'm going to start thinking about my reviews differently, by the way. Remember, 5 is a bang average.
Oh, we're going to have to change all your previous scores.
5 is a bang average.
For me, it's bang average. Don't make it your bang average if you don't want to. Because people get angry when I say that. So
quick maths, it's half of 10. So 5 is the average. This is a slightly above average film. So actually, 5.9.
Oh, nice. Okay, cool.
I'd say, genuinely. You know, this is going to affect previous scores, but, you know, let's reset. Let's just... Will's on a new path now. But, yeah, 5.9. There we go.
Okay. Rory, or shall I go?
I'll go. You can round us off. But I think we're going to argue forever about what ratings, like, the framework is. I think 5, to me, isn't average, because I think you should be aiming for above average. Like, any film should be above average.
Well, so this is my thing, is that anything we watch fundamentally, unless we're doing something deliberate, is a film above a 5, because we will never watch something that's Hollywood made that isn't built above a 5. And if we don't, that's why I'm making a note of it, is because it's so bad. But it's, you know, WandaVision, Falcon and the whatever the fuck that was, Justice League, these are films that were so fundamentally bad that I rated them below 5s. So almost everything I do rate is above a 5. So
all right.
To me, I'm going to say bang on 6, because I think I was going to say 5.8, but I'm tempted to push higher and higher just for the fact that there is a demographic who I feel will relate to this film much better than we can. So for me, it's 5.8 for what I think it kind of is to the world, a 6.
So that's interesting. I think I'm the highest one this week then. I think it's around a 6.5 or 6.6. I think I do believe that there are themes in there that I'm a sucker for environment. I love those sort of things. I think camera work for me makes up for a lot of shortcomings I fundamentally probably should have with films. But I do think that at points it is an effective commentary on certain things. I think sometimes it's a little bit cringe. You know, her friend Swanky, who goes to find those birds and stuff, like in that lake, or the, you know, as you said, the relationship thing, or even just her. I maybe it's possible, but getting a job everywhere she walks seems to me like a hard sell. But I still think it's, you know, it's soundly acted. It meanders, but it is still a good film. It's never going to be a great, but it's still a good film. I enjoyed weirdly seeing inside those factories. I mean, that's maybe something that's probably better off in just a documentary or whatever. But and it's maybe it's too focused on being a tribute and in memory of someone than it is to be an actual conventional film. But I still don't think that makes it a bad film. So I still think it's probably about 6.5.
There we go.
And that is a wrap on our 10th episode of Save the Star. But into double figures, something I've never achieved in cricket when batting. Bigger and better things coming up. All I really have left to do is say thank you to my co-captains, Rory and Will. Thanks for being here, lads.
Thank you, Harry.
Yes, thank you. Thank me. And the film we'll be watching next time, I'm not actually going to tell you. It's not because we haven't decided it, because obviously we have decided. But it's because we might be getting a cheeky little addition to the squad, a holding temporary midfielder for our front three of lethal attacking threat.
For one episode only. But,
well, we'll vet them. We'll see how they do. And if they're better than Will, they're better than Will. We can't know that yet. So, yeah, stay tuned for that. Keep stubborn.
Save the star. Save the star.